That Segundo couldn't make it this week for a very specific reason. In the interests of shamelessly garnering a mention on the vital stats page of A.L. Kennedy's official site, with a possible annotation that she was having a bad day, we wish to report the true story of our young roving correspondent's interview with A.L. Kennedy. After all, it's not the words that are important. It's that sinuous, sexy, slinkier writer. Oh, Alison Louise. She had smooth white porcelain skin that blew out the bulbs of the incandescent lighting above us and caused every electrician to burn with hard heartache as they screwed in the replacement's right word. Her eyes dazzled, causing my four ventricles to dance a spasm of hubba hubba. Yeah, baby. She won herself a Costa, but every man knows it will cost you to contend with the sharp Scottish pen and tongue that will lance you a new one if you aren't quick with the tongue. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think I need a cold shower. That hot and foxy rider, Allison, will do that.
Okay, so I am here with A.L. Kennedy, who is the author of Original Bliss, and most recently, Day. Allison, how are you doing?
Good, yeah. Kind of, bit jet-lagged.
Yes, the day after winning the Costa. I wanted to first of all ask you about Day. What came first in this book? It has a very specific stylistic quality. There's almost sort of a kind of Greek chorus quality to Alfred's inner consciousness. And I'm wondering, does style come from voice, or does voice come from style? In relation to this, and I mean, a lot of your novels have idiosyncratic characters along these lines.
Yeah, it's kind of both. This just will get really boring and technical. It's hard because I knew it was going to be a book about something very intense, mm-hmm. but you need a huge overview, so it couldn't be first person. It would have to be third person, but then third person and third person historic. So technically, it's actually the most distancing viewpoint you could think of. And then I just try to make up for that by. Making it a sort of close third person, but trying to get the second person to try and pull you in, so he's kind of getting you in with him. Partly also because he doesn't really disclose very much, so he isn't going to speak to you directly. It's as if he can have you standing next to him,
yeah.
And that's as good as he can do. But it's sort of an interaction between the narrative and the character, and just trying to make decisions about what kind of book you want it to be.
I mean, I'm wondering when the actual sentences entered the equation as you were writing this. Was it a matter of just trying to kind of get a handle on the voice, and then all of a sudden these other voices kind of entered into the equation, or what happened here? Or was there a lot of active thought and planning involved with this?
There's an amount. I try and not do active thought and just do subconscious things. I research things and think about books for a very, very long time, so that there's generally about 3 years when there are bits of them are around, so they'll develop. Something's kind of almost as if it's by themselves, and then I turn around and look at them and just kind of try and make them what they appear to want to be. I'm thinking about technical issues, but I'm trying not to let them be unorganic, if that makes sense.
But, I mean, inevitably there's wordplay that enters all of your books. There are many sort of jokes about, like, there's the line where you have he braked fast and things like that throughout the thing, and I'm it's sort of as if you're kind of almost hopelessly going to be occupied with the technical details. So, I mean, do you just go ahead and, is it just largely an organic process where you just have to just go ahead and nail down the sentences and just let them fly and then fix it later in revision, or?
I do write faster and tend to go forward, and I rewrite a lot, but I think the thing, when I initially started writing, I would rewrite hugely right at the time when I was writing, and then you just know it off by heart and you can't see it, and now I leave it longer and rewrite more. But some things happen, so, subconsciously, like with the story Original Bliss. I mean, I had somebody called Helen who'd left her husband to go to somebody else and completely forgot about the Greek precedent for that. The guy was a brain expert, and his initials were EEG. And I mean, just a lot of stuff happens with Paradise. There's a lot of, I knew it was a story about a kind of reflection of the Stations of the Cross, but there's a whole lot of Christ imagery that came in accidentally. Yeah. But I think if you cue your brain up to go in a direction, it will help you, and there are things you will never have to think about. It'll just, in the way that you see the face of the one you love in a crowd, without making an effort, even though they're not there. They're just things that your head tends to produce narrative out of chaos if you just leave it the hell alone.
I'm wondering, because you really like to challenge the reader, in these early drafts, do you sort of, as you revise, do you deliberately occlude things so that, oh, well, this is a little too obvious for the reader. We got to have the reader work here. Is it more intuitive than this?
I'm genuinely not trying to challenge the reader. It's just this is the way my head works. I try and be honest. I try and make the beginning characteristic of the rest of it. So if it really isn't your thing, you can leave early and you know what kind of part it's going to be. But I'm not actually trying to be hard. But people do find it very, very hard. I think the people who are into it are very, very into it. Yeah. Because it's such a specific thing, and clearly they're unhinged and don't often read books that fit with them. But then you hope that the middle ground will get into it enough that they can go with it. It's a specific voice, and it's an intrusive thing. I mean, reading, once you've opened yourself up to be in that conversation, you're allowing somebody to intrude. And if you've got some kind of strong voice or a slightly idiosyncratic voice, it can feel invasive. Mm-hmm. And some people do feel that I'm like messing with them, but I intend to.
But it could also be quite pleasant. Like, for example, actually, there's something I did want to ask you, and this was a bizarre question, mm-hmm. but there's a moment where Alfred enters his father's shop, mm-hmm. and you deliberately have the printing full of eels. And part of me was thinking, oh, is this kind of an homage to the Monty Python routine or whatnot? because, I mean, that makes sense, because we are talking about World War II, so hovercraft, I don't know.
I hadn't thought of that, but it could be. I am an admirer of the Pythons. I'll have to go back and reanalyze all of my fiction in the terms of...
But there's also, for example, the sergeant is named Hartnell, and I was thinking the way ahead. Oh, really? Okay, so...
Yeah, he played a lot of sergeants.
Yes, as well as the first Doctor, Doctor Who,
Who we love.
Yeah,
I'm slightly too young to remember him, but he did come back. He came when they were doing...
They had one of those three Doctors.
He was appeared as a whiffly hologram. I thought about, should I call him Hartnell or not? I mean, he obviously doesn't look like William Hartnell, but I just because it's a book slightly about what happens when a war becomes movies about a war and stops being real, I kind of thought that making him Hartnell. And plus, I do like a lot of the films of that period, so it was kind of just a little taking off of the hat to them.
Do these cultural references allow you to engage in this sense of play, or are they more of a sort of topographical trajectory, which I'm going to talk to you about topographically later, but I wanted to sort of talk about at least how this cultural reference deals with the idiosyncratic voice that we're talking about, or this sort of the sort of like natural ambiguity that you're putting into this book or your work.
Yeah, I mean, with this specific book, it's obviously there more because the majority of the readers will only know about that period through cultural artifacts, so you can't really get around that. I try not to rely on them just because I can't guarantee that the reader will know anything about what the hell I'm talking about. So they're certainly there, but I'm certainly wary. Like somebody was saying a couple of days ago, I don't really talk about the books that Alfred reads when he starts to read books. And again, I'm very wary of suddenly having a conversation about a book which you may not have the deep personal meaning that it has for him. You may have a different one, or just may not have read them. So a lot of the time they're not useful unless you can do something more with them.
Yeah. Well, there's also the idea that he reads mysteries, in Conan Doyle in particular.
Yeah.
And this seemed to me very funny because it's sort of like you're telling the reader, hey, it's a mystery, just like Alfred is reading mysteries.
Well, it's a crime story. He commits murder. And he gets away with it. And if you want to argue about area bombing, he commits murder more than once.
Yeah.
It is actually a crime story. And I did kind of sort of want to look at... How long have I been in the States? I wanted to look at ideas of crime a little bit and have that playing in the background, and a little bit about the things that we find exciting in a book or a movie of running around and having a gun and... being able to kill people for good reasons and that edge.
Going back to this issue of style versus voice, you give Alfred very interesting qualities. He's short, he's very deferential towards his mother. Mm. Little quirks like this kind of help you sort of understand Alfred's perspective, and I'm wondering if you need quirks along these lines in order to sort of at least kind of channel this particular perspective, particularly since you're talking about all the little other voices that are going on. How helpful are quirks in relation to the style and the voice?
I spend a long time with my people just continually doing this kind of forensic questioning thing. It is very much like the sort of, you know, William Peterson going, why did you do that? Because you are in that position. I think that's why writers produce a lot of drama where people sit in rooms going, then you stabbed the child, why didn't you stab the dog first? Because you spend so much time having this idea that came from apparently nowhere that, like, you know, that he has a moustache. Why does he have a moustache? And then eventually you get to the point of he has a scar. He's grown a moustache for a reason, to cover up the scar. Why is he covering up the scar now when he doesn't really seem to care about that kind of thing? Because somewhere in the back of his head he's going to go back to somebody that he wants to find him attractive. And those threads will start to interact and fire off each other. And that'll happen for a couple of years before I start writing. So I'll kind of, because you're just trying to know somebody as a person, because you have to present them, particularly because they don't exist, you have to make them exist quite a lot, otherwise I'm intruding on your time because you have real people you could be thinking about.
Well, there's also the fact that he wears the eye patch in the film shoot as well. It's almost sort of suggestive of a corporeal form that he is hiding quite deliberately and all that. That this is very much the fact that he can't really sort of accept himself and must put on these little sort of accessories, so to speak, whether it's growing a mustache or an eye patch. I'll throw this observation aside and ask about how important it was for you to sort of continually disguise Alfred throughout the course of this book.
I certainly had an idea that he would have multiple names quite early. I wanted him to have a name that could be abbreviated, and I wanted him to have a nickname, and I wanted the different context that he was in, because I knew he would have a specific accent. That came very early. So he would change his way of speaking, and as people do, and he would change his way of being. But I very much wanted him to have different names for different times, and him hearing a specific name would make him feel like a different person, which, again, you know, people do. Physically being disguised, I think, would probably come from that. But you have to bear in mind that anybody's reading of a book,
of course,
is a projection of themselves, and you're having very intelligent things to say about the book because you're, you know, my approach to the book is actually slightly less intelligent.
really You can't worry about how intelligent a book is. You just have to simply put it out there. Is that really what it boils down to? I've talked to many authors, and really it boils down to the conscious versus the subconscious, and often the subconscious is nowhere near, and that basically comes down to the reader.
Yeah, and I'm trying to let my subconscious do as much work as possible. Plus, you know, I'm guessing you're quite a visual person. I'm really not. My understanding of characters, I try and give them a visual existence because I know a lot of people understand that better. And, you know, statistically, you know, there's a huge number of nerve endings coming into your brain just about vision. I am terrible at recognizing people. I could meet you again an hour after we've done this. I wouldn't know you. If I hugged you, I would know what you smelt like, and I would remember you 10 years from now, because that's what works for me. So I kind of have to go in through the senses that work for me, and obviously I understand my characters because I know how Alfred smells and I know how he feels. And I try and do the other senses through the ones that are strong for me to give an illusion of them also being strong. But again, part of being a writer is you have to kind of know how you work and then try and deal with your strengths and weaknesses in a way that's, you can present something so that, you know, obviously that there's a limited number of senses and you're hoping that everybody has them or has an idea of what they would be like if they have some missing. So you're only working with a limited palette. But you have to know what, I think, what your little palette is like so that you can then present for a more general audience.
I'm curious, how did you establish how Alfred smells? I mean, what did you do? Did you just go around sniffing various old clothes from World War II, or what?
Yeah, I've certainly gone and looked at Browning 303 machine guns, and if you breathe on them, they smell of gun, and they smell of gun oil, and they smell of cordite. I've been in a Lancaster bomber, and again, breathe on it to try and make it hot. I spend a lot of time sniffing things, nibbling things, just because that works.
Nibbling things? What did you nibble?
You know, just little corners of... I don't want to go into that. Just to get the taste of things, because, you know...
This fossilized kind of MRE from World War II.
Oh, the food, yeah, jeez.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, you know, just to... to kind of understand and make it three-dimensional, and partly because it's fun, but yeah, to make it three-dimensional. But it's an interesting area to talk to other writers about, because there's a point at which if you're honest and like you're not doing an interview and having to pretend that you know what you're up to, you'll sort of say, you know, how do you know that an idea belongs with another idea and that it's to do with that story as opposed to another? And we all know, but we don't know why we know.
Mm-hmm.
And you use sense language to describe your knowing. Like I'll say, it all kind of tastes the same. Isn't that it actually does have a taste? That's how I would describe it. But it's, yeah, it's a fascinating area. But it is very, very blurry when you get down to the very beginning of it, because so much of it comes from whatever inspiration means.
Gotcha. There's one thing I wanted to remark upon this, and that is the way you use topography in relation to the senses. There's a couple of instances. For example, you have the smell of somewhere else on your skin near the end, which I found very interesting. You have the moon watching at its very highest.
Mm-hmm.
You have also he got hold of some toast from somewhere. Not some toast, just from somewhere. So the issue of place seems to me very much an important notion to Alfred, and I'm wondering how this came about, because it's often related in relation to food or sensuality and the like. It's almost as if he needs to find some topographical reference in order to sort of figure out who he is.
Yeah, again, it's a thread that came quite early. I think two things. I knew very early on, because it's one of the first things you find out about tail gunners, is that to bail out, if classically the way you're meant to, you're in this little turret, you revolve the turret round so that the door is open, and you fall out backwards into the night, which is such an extraordinary thing to do, even if the turret hasn't jammed and you've actually got your parachute and you're not on fire and blah, blah, blah. And that sense of being very far away from the rest of the crew, surrounded by perspex, not really surrounded by metal, so you can see the night and you're supposed to be looking into the face of nowhere, looking for small dark objects that are trying to kill you in a large dark space, sometimes when nothing is blowing up, and just as it immediately begins to suggest a sense of infinity and bottomlessness and the idea of looking down and just being hung over nothing. And the idea of the moon, because bombers would tend to use bright moonlight, full moonlight, which meant they could see more, but obviously be seen more. And there's in the UK, certainly there's slightly archaic now, but people talk about a bomber's moon, which is a big, bright moon. So I knew that the moon would be there, and I would have to use ideas of night, ideas of the moon. Obviously, he's called day. If he sees the beginning of the day, he's probably okay, because he's probably near to the UK or back in the UK. So there's this sense of having a nightlife and a day life. Those all wind in. Plus, I knew quite early on that he has to be a POW, because otherwise he can't be an extra in a POW film, having previously been one. And a lot of that experience quite often was to do with not having enough food or ultimately having no food. And obviously it's quite visceral anyway, being in love or having feelings or being afraid. You know, being afraid makes you throw up. So there must be a strong wire running through him, which is about wanting food, just wanting to be full.
Yeah.
So that was quite early on, and you knew that would run through, you know, when he ate, when he really wanted to eat and couldn't, when he could eat and didn't want to. And just this sense of, you know, how I did, actually not for the book, but just coincidentally, go for about a week without eating anything. And it is very interesting, just because you do start to be somebody else, because it's such a human regular thing to do. And if you don't do that thing, it's quite interesting.
Going a week without eating, are there any other sort of extraordinary research sensory things? And also nibbling. I think we're only getting a portion of the equation here of the steps you'll take to prepare for writing a book.
Licking strange objects. Well, no, I didn't intentionally not eat. I just I'd broken up with someone. I was very depressed, and my despair goes to my stomach. But at the time, you're also thinking, hey, it's useful. I can make notes. but no, I'll try and do mini versions of some things where I think I couldn't just extrapolate. But yeah, traveling to places, seeing things, tasting things.
Again, this topography. He also is guided by the turret's direction, as you have midway through the book. I mean, how important is topography for you as a novelist? Because it's very interesting how we don't really get a sense of the land just through the description, but definitely we do through his interior consciousness.
Yeah, again, because I'm not very visual, I have to try and fool you into having a visual sense of place. And I do, you know, I travel a great deal, so it's kind of making a benefit of a necessity. I see an awful lot of places. Just being a writer the last 20 years, I have literally traveled all over the world, sometimes multiple times. So I'm trying to make use of that. But again, to make it, the thing about visual information is just, it's far away. Not always, but you know, if you're standing on the top of a mountain, I can still see you. There's no detail, but I can still see you. I can't touch you, I can't taste you, I can't smell you. The area that I'm interested in is like, you know, it's like the length of a tongue away limits how much I could taste you.
Yeah.
I like intensity.
You say you're not a visual person, yet inarguably you are very concerned with words, which are visual in some way. So I'm going to have to sort of say, hey, I don't believe you.
Well, it kind of got better. And I'm, you know, faking it a bit. But no, I've absolutely the shape on the page. And when you read paragraph and typefaces and fonts... And you know, I love film. I love well-made film. I love photography, painting. You know, I just think it's my weaker sense.
Yeah.
I do adore it, but it's kind of more like looking at something that you don't understand how it's been generated.
Was there any particular precedent that you looked to for the various songs that are throughout this book? In fact, I wanted to ask you about the role of music. You have at one point, you write, the film people have. We're keen on singing because it seemed like high morale, which is, you know, actually quite true, even into our present age.
So
I wanted to sort of ask you about the role that music was. Is it more about tapping into that ambiguity of music that helps you perhaps draw upon this other ambiguity in words, for example? Is it more of an ambiguous notion rather than a visual notion, your relationship with words?
It's hard because, again, if somebody doesn't know the song that you're using and I wanted them to be period songs, you have to get around the song and make the gap where the song is have only one shape that would still be understandable. It's just you do see all of the movies and the whole, as you say, the wartime atmosphere, people do sing. And they do manipulate themselves to sing to have better morale. And I still kind of read about the period. I was reading this guy who's doing a sort of sociological diary, and very quickly he was saying there was a sing-song in the cinema, and this is like a few weeks after the war started, sing-song in the cinema, and normally the man would have had difficulty getting people to join in, and people apparently want to sing now, and they love singing, and they sang for a long time, and suddenly they turned into people who needed to sing together and be together and feel that thing. And talking about groups of people and talking about unexpressed feeling, group singing kind of allows you to say something without saying it and to be with people and to all breathe simultaneously and to try and get that feeling in. And obviously his mother's very religious, and he by putting in hymns and hymns about redemption, and you know, he hasn't really thought it out, but I think he does feel that he's unredeemed.
The fact that you use Jerusalem in that particular moment I just read is also a sort of telling sign. And again, going back to this issue of religion that we were talking about throughout the work. Yeah. I mean, you know, is religion one of those things you can't help but write about in a book? Or?
Yeah, well, it's an issue.
Or is it more of spirituality? I'm sorry.
Which kind of both. And again, you know, he's got that particular background, and for the area where he's living, it's fairly typical, because that's what the place where my grandparents came from. It would be an issue, and you know, as soon as you know you're going to die, you are going to start making decisions about who you pray to, or if you pray, or how you get yourself through. So I think it becomes much more live. So it wouldn't have been real to talk about it. And I mean, Jerusalem is such a gift, because it's you know, about being in a chariot of fire and having arrows, and it's certainly in the UK. It's very much a song that's a patriotic song, but it's loved by the right and the left, because it has, you know, quite a broad capacity there. So it was good, and it's quite an exultant song, which I wanted. You know, I wanted something where he could actually, again, express feeling maybe in a way that he couldn't otherwise. Yeah. And again, the popular songs, you know, I was looking for ones that were the right kind of cliches and the slightly annoying cliches. And then I came across quite late the I'll See You in My Dreams, which is not that well known. And it does just have these lines, you know, you will light my way tonight.
Are cliches in pop culture, going back to this issue, a very helpful mechanism for you to kind of avoid cliches in your own work and in your own sentences. And I mean, how do you deal with this notion of cliche in just on a basic text level?
At a certain level, it's a horrible cheat because you get the benefit of the cliche without having the responsibility because it's somebody else's. But it still fires. Mm-hmm. But you again, because it's a book about, I don't know, whether you tell the truth to yourself or you lie, whether you find, the one song which is about if you wish something hard enough it will come true, which is clearly patently not true. It's clearly hugely consoling if you're in a situation where that's all you've got.
Yeah.
But again, I wanted to talk about people who are in a situation where you decide, do I take the consoling lie or do I live in reality, even if it's really corrosive? And we have different people making different decisions.
Yeah. There's one thing we haven't even touched upon, Joyce, who mm-hmm. I found to be a really interesting poetic character. You've imbued her with these big round eyes, and you have the hat that Alfred carries, and you also have the quilt, which is, again, somewhat vaguely religious, maybe. But I wanted to ask you about why Joyce needed to have these great sort of poetic symbols, more so than any other figure in the book? Or is it a matter of just Alfred's perspective essentially sort of idealizing her?
I think, a lot of it is the way he sees her, I think. But, I mean, clearly she is quite something. Partly because, I mean, you know yourself, if you're under stress, if you're in love, your pupils hugely dilate and you see things differently. But if you're under stress, you're like that anyway. So everything is three-dimensional and firing. And, I mean, so many veterans, even if they hated the war they were in. I remember seeing a film of a Vietnam veteran sitting around, and they were totally trashed. They couldn't have relationships. They'd had years and years and years of nightmares and fear and sweats and physical unhealth, ill health and mental ill health and not being able to have a woman near them for any length of time, and then they suddenly started talking about how it felt and the fact that they had been more alive then than they ever had been, and it's kind of the ultimate betrayal that there is this glory about it because you existed 100%, and he's in that position really extremely just because of having to go away and do this weird thing and come back and people are having tea and everything else hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And it's like a hyper-exaggeration of the war experience anyway. And he sees this woman who's sort of what he wants to be like because she's well-read and she knows about books and she's kind. She seems to remind him of his mother. He never says so, but there are kind of slightly mothery things about her and he can save her in the way he couldn't save his mother. She kind of had to be... She had to be wonderful, but she also has to be wonderful because then she betrays him in an unavoidable way. I mean, you completely... she has to do what she had to do.
Well, his relationship with his mother, he notices, for example, the burn on her leg, and it's almost as if you immediately know at that moment, this explains why he's so diffident around women. Mm-hmm. And sort of devising a sort of symbol like that, I mean, just some key indicator that immediately communicates a character, how much do you sort of dwell upon this? Or is this, again, largely a sort of subconscious situation? Or are there particular points in your narratives where you know, where we're going to actually reveal everything to the reader and it's going to become immediately sort of clear?
Again, it's a result of asking questions. I think I got first that he hated his father. Yeah. And quite a lot of people who really, really take to the army, they have dysfunctional fathers, families, and there is a thing. You'd think you wouldn't go somewhere with big authority male figures if you had a real problem with your father, but quite often you do go to kind of, I don't know, repeat it but get it right, or do it again but different. And then you're asking, you know, why does he hate his father? And why does he hate his father so much? Because I had a clear sensation, it's like being a medium or something, but I had a clear sensation that he killed his father. Mm. Which is a real problem because normally you can't kill people in a book. Have your hero do that, you know, unless it's very specifically a noir type of book or, you know, a big excuse. And there's kind of, I did want him to have an excuse, but actually not that much of an excuse. You know, I wanted him to do something that would mirror area bombing, some kind of remote murderousness, that he would have this kind of darkness in him. And then that wound back to, well, yes, but he is naturally a psycho. He does have a reason for being very, very angry. Because again, very early on, there was this idea of a very small, tight-packed guy who just was blazingly angry about something. Mm-hmm. And it's not that, you know, he's nuts and is just randomly angry.
I have to ask you about the name Donald Antrobus, who is Joyce's husband. Where did Antrobus come from? I mean, that's a really extraordinary, or Antrobus, I don't know.
No, in Britain it's Antrobus. I actually know an Antrobus. He's a scriptwriter, a comedy scriptwriter. It just sounded like a period name. It just does sound slightly posh and slightly 1940s.
It sounds, though, like sort of this weird hybrid, because here you have this war essentially decimating any strands left from the Victorian era, the modern age coming in, and Antrobus sort of basically, it's like a bus coming in and taking things away. This is the feeling I sort of got from your book in terms of, well, you're seeing the last vestiges of a romantic age essentially decimated, and this is why the relationship between Alfred and Joyce is also so just absolutely touching to me, because it's sort of, you're seeing them trying to grope at something that is in the process of decaying, and I wanted to ask you, in addition to the topographical, which we discussed, the notion of temporal change along these lines, some great kind of momentum in the air. How much was this the driving force in the book?
Yeah, it's very big. Obviously, his sensation of time is very strange because he lives a lifetime in 8 hours, two or three times a week. But the rest of the time is speeded up too, or it can be, and again, people talk about it all the time, how time is compacted or stretched. And yeah, I mean, it's partly why I've always wanted to write a book in this period, because it's so interesting, because as you say, social mobility suddenly became massively increased. A kind of meritocracy worked out, because you're either useful or not, and it doesn't really matter if you're an Antrobus or a Day. If you can do the job, you're going to be appreciated, kind of. And I wanted it to be about the sort of the passing of people like Pluckrose and people like Antrobus and Britain for a while becoming different, but you know, we've swung right back to the old ways now. But a sense that the classes were breaking down, a sense that some gentility was leaving, but also that some, you know, that sense of community. She's quite a sort of Fabian society type of person, I thought, you know, reading Gallant's books, I think she would read. And the sense that people are sustained by narrative, you know, literally that Alfred reads, Ivor talks about it, and it's statistically true during the war, people read more than they ever have since.
Yeah. And poetry in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and really became a different society, and people expressed themselves naturally through poetry.
Yeah.
And just an awakening of something that's actually very, very tender. I mean, there's this very famous poem, High Flight, beautiful poem written by a fighter pilot who died about the middle of the war. It's just this extraordinary transcendent poem. We make a lot of fuss about the First World War poets, but they're extraordinary Second World War poets, and some who actually bridged the gap, who are amazing. So, you know, to talk about that, to talk about people who really made this desperate effort to preserve civilization and gentility just when it appeared to be all going up in smoke, and really kind of made personal efforts to keep things going.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting to me because there's also the notion of war changing language. I mean, there's, of course, the Paul Fussell book, The Great War in Modern Memory, which deals mostly with the First World War, but there is some dwelling on the Second World War. Was this a sort of idea in your mind when you were writing this? Did you want to sort of demonstrate how the war just really kind of devastated Alfred's way of communicating? I mean, it's clear definitely in the voice, but were there any specific language things that you did in order to sort of show, just, look, this was a serious thing? I mean, it basically changed everything, you know?
Yeah, because it kind of unpicks his consciousness. And that, you know, he starts off with a particular dialect and a working class way of speaking, and again, a dialect which is almost extinct now. Which again, he kind of wanted to show how lovely the Staffordshire accent, Black Country accent was. Now it's all kind of become very bland. But yeah, he has, and some of the things, again, you're talking about things that there are no words for, which is slightly part of why Vassal is there. I just remember seeing an interview with a German soldier, a Wehrmacht soldier who'd been with his unit, an officer, and this guy had gone out to look at, to see there's this kind of disturbance, and they sent out a scout to see what was happening. And what was happening was a mass execution. The SS were executing people and civilians, and they were going into a pit. And the guy came back, and he looked, you know, haggard. And, you know, this is his side. And the officer had said to him, you know, what's happened? And the guy said, I can't tell you. You have to come and see. Mm-hmm. And they literally had no language with which to say what this terrible thing was. They all just had to go and look at it. And I didn't want to press things into language, but to just, you know, slightly suggest that there were what war does is to open up inexpressible things, yeah. and it's very difficult to fight something or to even describe something if there is no language for it.
But not just inexpressible, as you pointed out earlier, there are specific skills that one kind of keeps, and you have Alfred, for example, at the film shoot. He's taking these tins of carnation and he's trying to do a makeshift stove, and this seemed both funny and sad to me that okay, I went ahead and I went through the war and I have all these skills and now I'm essentially reduced to basically trying to find ways in this rather strange life as a person in the film shoot to use ways of reusing these particular skills.
Which is the big thing about the military, because they always say you will learn a trade for life.
Yeah.
And they never say, like people now say, going postal.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says that's the career that you get offered when you leave the military. It's not that being a postman makes you nuts. It's the fact that being trained to kill people and then becoming a postman may make you want to go wild with a weapon at some point.
I'm wondering if that's like an American neologism, because
we completely don't understand it in the
people
UK.
People go to become a postal employee here just out of desperation, you know, sometimes
this weird crazy postal thing, and it's actually a military thing. And also it does give you, you know, largely in the area of killing people skills, you know, it gives you a whole set of skills which have no other possible useful application. It's like, I know how to kill people with my thumb.
I know how to take out a guy with a sniper rifle. Great, you know.
I know how to look at somebody and assess how I would kill them. Great. And I know people who know, you know, I've sat in bars with guys and he said, you know, he would be a problem. He thinks he would be a problem, but he wouldn't. I'd get him first. None of those guys. And they know. Because they've been trained to look at rooms that way, and it's like, it's an interesting skill, but given that nobody in here is trying to kill you.
Well, this is interesting because it would also explain Alfred's muted masculinity, because often with men, it's sort of like, oh, well, I am what I do, and, you know, it's sort of, again, the usual question that you're asked first at a party. It's like, whoa, what do you do? You know, and how very much we're bound by vocation, and here he is, and it's... Was it easy for you to tap into this kind of fluctuating vocation that Alfred has by way of being a writer and kind of setting your own hours? Did this come natural? Or?
I think, and I've met over the years, I used to work in prisons and I know sort of former military people. Everybody I've met, apart from the people who were crazy and were in mental, secure mental facilities, everybody I've met who's killed people, and particularly who's killed people habitually, has been incredibly quiet and polite and contained, because you just don't have to try anymore. It's like you don't have to prove anything, because if you're going to get any bother, you can kill them.
Yeah. Or the great sort of achievement of your life is now behind you.
Kind of.
You've made your name, you've been into the newspapers, and now it's time to sort of settle in, I suppose.
And you sort of understand that, I mean, partly this is to do with prisons, because if things get out of hand, then bad things will happen. With regard to the backlash from the authority, but you basically know that if people get too emotional, bad things will happen, or bad things may happen. It's almost a type of fear, and it's not that they can't handle themselves, it's just I know that if it gets above that degree, people may die, and I actually do want to avoid that. So they have a peculiar way of being socially, and you know, I wanted Alfred to have that from, you know, looking at people who do martial arts, people who have been in the military and have learnt, you know, having that body memory thing that, because my grandfather taught me self-defense when I was really, really young. A lot of the games we played were about actually how to disable attackers.
Really?
Which was just fun. And I mean, he's never made me feel that I was actually under threat. But again, a couple of times if something has happened with a guy, I found myself doing what I was told to do.
Yeah.
Totally without thinking about it.
Wow.
You know, you just do the thing that you were trained to do. And I definitely wanted them to have that.
Yeah. Well, I know you have to talk to tons of people and I have tons of questions, but we'll have to do this again sometime. Allison, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Though you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me.